VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello and welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. This year marks the 100th anniversary of what many call the deadliest influenza pandemic in history. Called the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, the H1N1 virus strain spread around the world between 1918 and 1919. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated that 500 million people, or one-third of the world's population, became infected with the virus. It's reported that 50 million people died in the pandemic. A factor that made the pandemic unique was that mortality was not only high among the most vulnerable, people 5 years and younger and 65 and up, but healthy people, including those between 20 and 40 years old. Among other factors, global events such as World War I was thought to have played a role in such a rapid and widespread of this deadly strain of the flu. Also keep in mind that medical professionals in 1918 didn't have many of the important tools that are used to treat and mitigate an influenza pandemic today. There were no flu vaccines to prevent infection, nor any antibiotics to treat secondary infections related to the flu. Public health workers then could only rely on non-medicinal methods, such as using disinfectants, isolating and quarantining those infected with the flu virus, and encouraging good personal hygiene. Could a devastating flu pandemic such as what happened in 1918 happen again? If so, are medical professionals and the public health community properly prepared to meet the challenges of such a global health crisis? Today, we'll look back at the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic and talk about the lessons learned from this disaster. In studio with me is my co-host, VOA health reporter Carol Pearson. And our guest who joins us by telephone from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Dr. Amesh Adalja, M.D. He's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and an expert in infectious diseases, critical care, and emergency medicine. Dr. Adalja, can you tell us about the particular strain of the influenza virus that caused the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic?
The virus that was responsible for causing the 1918 pandemic was an influenza A virus that was new to the general population. It was an H1N1 that had its origin likely in an avian species. All the genes came directly from some avian species into humans. So that made it something that many people had no immunity to. There probably were some people that had seen something similar to it, but a great quantity of the population of the world had never seen a virus like it before. And that's what led to it having such a prolific spread and devastating impact.
The virus was an H1N1, wasn't it?
Yes, it was an H1N1.
And is it also called the swine flu?
We don't usually talk about it as a swine flu. I think that when you think about flu viruses, it can get a little complicated trying to keep avian and swine and human species separate. But what we do know is during 1918, there were hypotheses that maybe this originated in swine. But we've been able to now sequence that virus and see that it is of avian origin. That doesn't mean that swine weren't infected, and it's unclear what role they might have played in 1918, whether they were amplifying it, whether they were getting secondarily infected, or whether they may have been responsible. Maybe the virus went from birds to pigs and then to humans, or maybe it went directly from birds to humans. All of that really hasn't been established firmly. But in general, swine are very promiscuous when it comes to flu viruses. They can be infected by both human strains and avian strains, and they sometimes serve as what's called a mixing vessel, where the flu virus can kind of swap genes inside a pig, and that allows new combinations to occur and new viruses to emerge. And indeed, that's what we saw with the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, our last flu pandemic, where swine played such a major role. So in general, we try to use the word swine for viruses that emanate directly from a pig. In general, people have gotten away from it because there's a lot of misnomers that happen as well, because then people will start believing that pork products are infected, and you can have people causing major economic calamities based on the fact that something is called a swine flu when it really has little to do with the meat, but with the mixing vessel role of the pig.
Are people, human beings, more susceptible to getting flus that originate in a swine as opposed to in a bird flu?
In general, the answer is yes. People can be infected, however, by flus directly from birds as well. So we were talking about H7N9 a lot in public health circles. That's a bird flu circulating in China. That's coming directly from birds to humans. But we do know that the pig immune system and the pigs in general, their physiology is more like a human than a bird's this. So viruses that can infect pigs are likely going to have some changes in them that make them more likely to be able to be successful at infecting humans. But it's not 100%. Like I said, you can have direct transmission from birds, but pigs do serve this important role. And we've seen in recent years these variant flu viruses that have been spreading in agricultural fairs from swine into children mostly, where they get there maybe at a petting zoo exhibit at a fair, and they pick up one of these viruses. So definitely swine viruses can infect humans directly.
Can you go over the history of the 1918 flu? It's been called the Spanish flu. It infected about a third of the world's population. Can you explain the spread too?
You can't really talk about 1918 without really situating it in the broader context of what was going on at that time. And what was going on was the First World War. And that led the virus to be able to really exploit troop movements all over the world and spread very rapidly in a way that viruses prior to 1918 had a lot of difficulty doing. So that's sort of what's responsible for its spread. The reason why it's called Spanish influenza is kind of an interesting story. And it has to do with the fact that during World War I, many countries had censorship laws instituted where you couldn't write anything that might decrease the morale of the public. And because of that, a lot of the countries that had flu cases weren't really able to fully report it. So countries like Spain, which didn't have those laws on the books, were able to talk about this virus much more freely. And because of that, they were able to say that they had cases. And then kind of by circumstance, the virus became known as the Spanish flu. Of course, they didn't know it was a virus at that time, but the illness became known as a Spanish flu. Our best guess to the origin, and I think there's still a lot of hypotheses that are floating out, is that it actually probably originated in Kansas in the United States in a training camp is where more and more evidence is pointing to. So, in fact, it wasn't really a Spanish flu. It probably was an American flu.
Back in 1918, we saw the end of World War I. What was the effect and impact of the World War on the pandemic?
Well, the World War directly facilitated the spread of this virus as people were traveling back to their home countries. And you had mixing, you had training camps, you had lots of opportunities where the virus could have explosive spread. And if you read the history of 1918, you can hear these stories, for example, in Massachusetts, where there were training camps that were inundated with flu cases that really outstripped the ability to care for them. And I believe at that time, Calvin Coolidge might have been the governor of Massachusetts, and there was a he had asked for federal help from President Wilson. All of that was happening because of the fact that we had this clustering of people. And we know that viruses love to spread in closed populations, and we still see that in training camps for military, that we have certain viruses that can spread. And I think you can't think about 1918 without realizing that this world war and the troop movements and the troop gatherings and the mixing of people really was what facilitated this having that kind of an impact that no other flu pandemic had ever had in the past.
I understand the 1918 flu not only killed the young, old, and vulnerable, as flu does, but also healthy people, young people as well. Why did this happen?
Well, you have to think about, when you think about flu, we talk about what's called a U-shaped epidemic curve. So you see the cluster of the severe illness in the very young and in the very old. But in the pandemic of 1918, we had what was called a W-shaped epidemic curve, where you saw the old and the young affected, but also this peak in the middle, people in their prime of life that were getting affected. And that's something that's very characteristic of pandemic flus. And what it has to do with is the fact that people have this history with flu viruses. So viruses circulate, or something similar might circulate, and you get some immunity to it. And it just seemed that that group of people in the prime of life during 1918 had not seen a flu virus similar to that one that was responsible for 1918. So they were more disproportionately affected because their immune systems really were unprepared for it. And coupled with that, the fact that their immune systems are robust and during the prime of life, they tend to have an exaggerated response and cause a lot more damage than someone who's very young or very old because their immune system is much more powerful. So you take the fact that they were naive to that virus and they had very robust immune responses. You put those two things together, and they had very severe cases of infection where you had lots of destruction of the lungs, where you had secondary bacterial infections. happening at a much higher rate than in the extremes of age.
And would you add to that the fact that there was no influenza vaccine, there were no antibiotics, and there was no treatment like Tamiflu?
Yes, certainly I would say that part of the burden of the 1918 pandemic has to be understood in the light of the fact that there was no vaccine. They didn't even know that flu at that time was caused by a virus. There were no antivirals. There were no antibiotics for secondary bacterial infections. And most of the data shows that the deaths were largely caused by secondary bacterial infections, not the virus itself. And you had very, very little supportive care. We didn't have intensive care units or mechanical ventilators. None of that was really available. So in a sense, the 1918 pandemic happened at a time that modern medicine really was non-existent. And I think that that's an important lesson, that we do have a lot more tools, even though we still face a pandemic risk. So maybe some of that would be blunted because of our antibiotics, our vaccines, and our modern critical care.
Would you also say that, you know, if you're looking at a pandemic, is a pandemic just a seasonal virus gone wild and spread around the world, or is it something that is entirely different?
To be able to cause widespread infection and have this scope over the entire world, you will see the flu virus usually acquiring some new ability. So it may be that it's got new genes, because it has to be able to evade the immune system of the majority of the population to be able to infect at such a high rate. So in essence, that really restricts it to getting some kind of new genes. So we see some reshuffling or reassortment of the virus each time that there's been a pandemic. So the H1N1 pandemic in 2009 was a new H1N1 virus. The one in 1968 was a new H3N2. The one in 1957 was an H2N2. And in 1918, of course, there was an H1N1. So each of our pandemics, you've seen a new flu virus emerge from another species and jump into humans and exploit the vulnerability in the immune systems of the population of the globe.
And the last pandemic was a mild case of flu. It did kill people, you know, and it did sicken people. However, it wasn't as horrible as people were anticipating. Is that, can you explain why not?
Well, the 2009 H1N1 pandemic was a pandemic by every measure, and it did kill at a high rate, and it did break some records for outpatient visits, and it was very disruptive to the world in general. However, people were expecting a 1918 type of event, or even something similar to what we were seeing with bird flus in terms of mortality rates, and you didn't get that. However, the H1N1 pandemic in 2009, if you look at who died, the average age of death was again, similar to 1918. It was people in the prime of life. And if you take that into consideration, that's a substantial burden on a population, because that is the group of people that are taking care of children. They are the ones that are the primary participants in the workforce. So if you look at the people who died and multiply how many years of life they have left and then compare it to the other pandemics, it does measure up comparably to them. However, in general, it was a milder pandemic, and it may have been because we had some built-up immunity, because this H1N1 virus was something that was in many ways similar to the H1N1s that circulated between 1918 and 1957. There was some population immunity that was there. So some people were protected because of their prior experience with similar H1N1 viruses. And then we also had antivirals. We had a vaccine. We have modern medicine and modern critical care and antibiotics. So all of that may have played a role. But in general, I think the biggest factor was the fact that a large proportion of the population had had experience with it. And because of that, we didn't see the death toll that people were expecting with the 1918 type of virus.
Let's take a break now. This is the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, or from iTunes. And we hope you'll get in touch with us either through Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. Now, back to our program. Today, we're talking about influenza and the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. In studio with me is my co-host, VOA health reporter Carol Pearson. And our guest who joins us by telephone is Dr. Amesh Adalja, MD, from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Dr. Adalja, as you and Carol mentioned a little earlier in our program, modern medicines like vaccines and antibiotics weren't around in 1918. So I'm curious, just how was the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic handled then as a public health issue, and how were the patients treated?
Really, it was just supportive care. So they may not have had any medicines that would actually work. They didn't have access to any kind of sophisticated critical care. So there really was just kind of supportive care, basically holding the hands of the patients. And people might have tried some folk remedies or non-evidence-based types of things that may or may not have had any kind of impact. And from a public health perspective, since there was no vaccine, it was really social distancing. So people might have been wearing masks. There's famous pictures during World War I victory parades of people wearing masks. Maybe movie theaters and public gatherings were curtailed. You might have seen hospitals restrict visitation to try and tame the spread of this. But again, they didn't even know it was a virus at that point. So everything was really going to be futile until you knew what was going on. And all they could really do was this kind of social distance and hygiene and washing your hands. In many ways, I think that they were very helpless in the face of this virus in 1918.
Would you expect that we would see another flu virus like that in 1918, that we would see this happen again?
When you think about influenza, pandemics are the rule, and we are overdue for a severe pandemic if you kind of look at history. So most experts believe that we are still at risk from a major influenza pandemic, and we got lucky in 2009 with a mild pandemic. And there are many candidate viruses, and we mentioned H7N9, one of the avian flu viruses that's circulating in China, as a very high suspect for our next pandemic virus. But we could be surprised. But I do think that you can't discount the fact that we are ripe for a pandemic, that this is something that we need to think about and prepare for. And we may not be as lucky as we were in 2009.
Doctor, what did medical science learn following the pandemic?
The biggest takeaways at that time was that infectious diseases were major forces, even in the developed world at that time, that they could be very destructive to the world's economy, to the world's population, and could exploit the new globalization that occurred. Because if you had to think about what it was like prior to the world wars, in general, people were much more segregated. There was less travel. Travel times were very slow. But what you see in the 1900s, increasing even till today, is that viruses can exploit travel and can get from one side of the globe to the other very quickly and can turn from a small problem in some exotic location to a problem that everybody is dealing with. And I think that's the biggest lesson that I take from 1918 how to think about pandemics in the future, is that our travel times and the world population really facilitates the fact that viruses can go from one part of the world to the other. And you have to be prepared and not think that you are kind of some kind of castle on the hill that no virus is going to be able to penetrate. That this is something that was illustrated in 1918 and 1957 and 1968 and 2009. I also think that because people knew that this was a flu outbreak, it really put flu on the top list of public health priorities. And not soon after, a couple decades later, we started to have a flu vaccine. We had the discovery of the virus that causes flu. And since 1918, I would say that flu has become the priority pathogen when you think about what is a global catastrophic biological risk. That flu always on the top of the list because of what it did in 1918.
And this is what public health officials realize. Yet, why doesn't this filter down to the general population? Here we have, close to 30% of parents saying they're not going to get their children immunized against the flu this year. And a lot of people consider the flu just like a bad cold.
It's really unfortunate because we have the experience of 1918. There's been countless books written about 1918, and many historians, as well as public health and medical professionals, know very well what 1918 was capable of doing. However, in any given season, wide varieties of illnesses where many people don't get sick or they have a mild illness, so they kind of shrug it off and say that was just the flu, it's not something that serious. And they often confuse it in their mind with the common cold and not really realize that it's a different type of virus and that flu has a lot more to it than the common cold. And I would also say that we have a vaccine that's the best flu vaccine that we have, and it's the best means to prevent the flu, but it isn't a vaccine with the efficacy levels of, for example, the measles vaccine. So there is that fact about the flu vaccine that might dissuade people because they don't think it's very good. And speaking medically, it isn't the best of our vaccines, but it's the only one we've got right now. So all of that kind of couples together and creates kind of a perfect storm for poor vaccination rates against influenza. And it's also not something that schools require, and that's usually a nudge that gets people to vaccinate their children. But if a school doesn't require the flu vaccine, It's not something that you're going to see people go out of their way to get if they are already opposed to it.
Doctor, when you vaccinate a person against the flu, is it for a specific type or subtype, or does it generally fight off all different types of flu?
The current flu vaccines either cover 3 to 4 strains, depending upon which vaccine you get. And they are targeted based on the strains that are likely to circulate in the upcoming season. And that's an analysis process that goes on with the World Health Organization and the CDC. And they come up with the best estimate to which viruses are going to circulate. And they sometimes can get it wrong, you know, which we've seen multiple years in the recent past. But there is no such thing as a universal flu vaccine. And that's considered the holy grail in the field of infectious disease. To get a flu vaccine that you don't have to update every year, that you don't have to change, that you get once and provides lifelong immunity the way we do with our measles shots. People get 2 measles shots and that's the end of that. We don't have anything near that with flu. Flu is a much trickier virus and it's really eluded our attempts to make a universal flu vaccine. But that doesn't stop researchers. I think it's probably one of the highest priorities when it comes to flu is developing a universal flu vaccine, which would really change the way we deal with flu and would probably take it off of those lists of scary diseases if we could tame it with a universal vaccine.
And Dr. Adalja, a lot of people seem to think that you can get the flu if you get vaccinated against it. Is that at all true?
No, the flu vaccine cannot give you the flu. The vaccine, if you get the injectable forms, it's just basically pieces of the virus. The nasal flu vaccine is a special type of flu virus that can only be viable in your nose, so it can't actually cause anything in your airways or anything like that. So you cannot get the flu from the flu vaccine, either one of them. And the thing that's important to remember is that the flu vaccine takes 2 weeks to actually build up immunity in your body. So if you get the flu vaccine on a Monday and somebody sneezes on you on a Tuesday and you get sick on Thursday, it's not the flu vaccine that gave you the flu. It was that person that sneezed on you, and the flu vaccine didn't have the chance to actually be able to do anything in your body because it takes 2 weeks. But many people kind of don't realize that, and they fall victim to sloppy thinking and say, I got the flu vaccine, and now I've got the flu 3 days later. That must have been the vaccine, not the people that were sneezing on you or the coughing on you, or maybe you were even incubating the flu before you even got the vaccine.
Doctor, you were mentioning injection and nasal variations of the vaccine. How many types of flu vaccines are available generally during a year?
We've actually kind of have a menu now. There are several different flu vaccines. So we've got, even within the injectable, there's multiple different injectables to choose from. There is one that's considered cell-based, one that's recombinant, then there's an ordinary one. There's one that are injected into your muscle, some that are injected into your skin, some that are using a jet injector. For the elderly, we have high-dose flu vaccines, which have more material in them, and another vaccine that has an immune stimulant called an adjuvant in them. Then we have the nasal flu vaccine. So it's really, I think, a great thing that we have this many flu vaccines, and we're making incremental improvements in them. But it becomes confusing, and many doctors who aren't up to date in the flu field may not know, and they aren't all interchangeable. And it's kind of hard to pick the best one for each patient if you don't keep up with that. But we do have a lot of flu vaccines. But in general, I think it's important to talk to your doctor about which vaccine might be best for you, especially if you're elderly and you may benefit from the high dose or the adjuvanted vaccine.
And when's the best time to get vaccinated? Is it before the season starts, at the start of the flu season, or just before it heightens?
This is a bit of controversy. We've come to learn in recent years that the earlier you get the flu shot, the less long it's going to last, and you might be susceptible again towards the tail end of the season. However, this is tricky to do from a public health perspective because we have low vaccination rates against the flu. We want people to get vaccinated no matter what. So we want people to get vaccinated, even if they can get vaccinated, if they have to get vaccinated early. That's kind of the first public health priority. But if you could choose and you're still going to get your vaccine and you're not going to forget, I think that it's important to have your vaccine maybe by the end of October when the flu season starts in earnest. We start seeing cases really ramp up in December, for example. So some people even push it into November. But it's important to make sure you get your flu vaccine. So this is a bit of tricky public health messaging to try and get people to get their flu vaccine before we start trying to tweak when the exact timing is to get that vaccine.
Doctor, I've seen seasonal and pandemic influenza. Is there a difference between the strains of flu, between a seasonal flu and a pandemic flu?
Yes, the seasonal variants tend to be very similar. They maybe vary from season to season a very small amount, and that we make some adjustments in the vaccine, and that's usually the end of it. They don't usually cause major worldwide destruction and devastation the way a pandemic virus does. Pandemic viruses are characterized by something that's novel, that the immune system of the majority of the population of the world have not seen. And that's what we look for. They call them, they're basically shifts in the virus, whereas what you see in between seasons are a little bit of drifting of the virus. But when you see a major shift, that's when we worry about a pandemic occurring.
I had another question, and it goes back to when you should get the flu vaccine. If you say at the beginning of the season for the United States, that's in October, what about the idea of getting a booster towards the end or middle of the season? Would that help at all?
There is some talk of doing that. And indeed, when we vaccinate children the first time for flu, we give them two shots. We give them one shot and then a booster shot. However, I think, again, this runs into that tricky public health messaging, is that we can't get people to get one vaccine, let alone two. And I don't know that there's been enough data to support the fact that that may work. And I think that the final solution to this really is to get a better flu vaccine that doesn't wear off during the season. And I think that's where lots of the focus has been. I don't think there's any harm in getting two flu vaccines if you're very high risk, but I don't know that there's any evidence that it may work yet, that booster might work. And I do think there probably will be studies that try to address that, but it's going to be hard to implement when we have such gaps in getting people vaccinated once in a season, let alone twice.
Doctor, you mentioned people that are high risk. Who are people that are at high risk?
People that are high risk for flu are those at the extremes of age, very young, very old, those with other medical problems, for example, lung disease is a big one, so asthma, COPD, emphysema, those people who are suffering from cancer and maybe are getting chemotherapy and their immune systems are altered, those people who have had organ transplantation and are on immunosuppressive medication, those people with certain rheumatologic diseases like rheumatoid arthritis who are getting immunosuppressing medication, those people with HIV that maybe are not on medications or their immune system has been damaged by the HIV virus. Pregnant women are one of the highest risk groups that are often overlooked and have really were hit hard during the 2009 pandemic. That probably covers all of the major high risk groups that I can think of off the top of my head.
Do you see differences between the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere? For example, in the Northern Hemisphere, right after the holidays, you know, in December and January, that's where you see the peak. And people do a lot of traveling, and they're together, and they're indoors, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, whereas those particular holidays in the Southern Hemisphere happen in the summertime. So you would have Christmas, New Year's Day in the summertime. Would you expect to see a difference in the spread of flu?
Yeah, we definitely do. It's been well established that the northern and southern hemispheres have kind of mirror image flu season. So right now they're not in the beginning of their flu season. Their flu season has just ended. And that has to do with the way the virus likes to spread and the environmental and humidity conditions that make it more likely to spread. So we do see the exact opposite. We get our flu season, you know, October through February and March, and theirs is the opposite. So that's important. If you're traveling to the Southern Hemisphere in the middle of summer, you're going right into their flu season. So some people would recommend getting a flu vaccine if one was available. And sometimes the vaccines for the Northern and Southern Hemisphere are completely different or a little bit different, depending upon which strains are circulating. So I think that's an interesting thing about flu, is that it exploits weather patterns on the planet. And we have basically two different seasons depending on which hemisphere you're in.
Doctor, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to leave you with a final question. What can people do to help themselves from getting the flu?
The number one thing people can do to prevent themselves from getting the flu is get the flu vaccine. That's the best measure that we have against this vaccine, this virus. It's not the best vaccine, but it does help with preventing you from getting the flu. And if you do get the flu, despite the fact that you were vaccinated, your flu is less likely to be severe, less likely to result in hospitalization, pneumonia, or death.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. Our guest was Dr. Amesh Adalja, MD, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, headquartered in Baltimore, Maryland. I'd like to thank my co-host for today's program, VOA health reporter Carol Pearson, as well as our studio technician, Evan Anichka. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castillo next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.